Greetings once again to you, my fellow man. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview.
I hope this battery lasts.
That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney, coming to you on a hot, hot, hot summer afternoon here 1 mile closer to God in Denver, Colorado. And welcome, once again, to the weekly broadcast where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the events of the week and focus them through the lens of original thought. It's good to have you all on board here as we attack another week that lies before us. And going through the news this week, I just didn't find all that much that was really funny. So today's show will probably not be a giggle fest. I'm sorry, but the news is quite disturbing out there. And so I'm hoping, as we go through the news, that we'll find a few things that will bring a chuckle, but also a few things that will make you think and make you consider the fact that we are perilously close to the rim of hell here in Western civilization. Let's start out from the international file. The most disturbing story of the week, no doubt. I got this story from the Mail over in London. Not my mail, or not my email, but there's a newspaper in England, apparently, that's called the Mail. The Daily Mail, even. And it's about a gentleman named, let's see if I can pronounce this, Abdelbaset Ali Mohammed Al-Megrahi. You all may remember him. You may. He's the Lockerbie bomber, and he was released this week from a Scottish prison, and he landed in Libya. He landed in Libya to a hero's welcome as thousands greeted him at the airport waving flags and posters. That's right. That's according to the Mail from London. His release prompted a furious reaction from America, with Barry Ho branding it a mistake. Barry Ho wants to go on record that releasing the Lockerbie bomber was a mistake. Now, for all you youngsters in the crowd, this is back in 1988. A plane inexplicably exploded over Lockerbie, Scotland, killing all 270 passengers on board. And Mr. Abdelbaset Ali Mohammed Al-Megrahi was duly convicted in Scottish court of being a prime mover, planner, plotter, and executor of the plan, the plot, to blow up the flight TWA. I can't remember the flight number. That's how long ago it's been, and this bastard is still alive, for crying out loud. I was shocked when I turned on the news to find out that this fellow was still alive, let alone being set free by Scottish officials. Now, let's see. What else did Barry Ho say? Anything else? The U.S. president's pleas for Tripoli to refrain from idolizing Megrahi when he landed on home soil apparently went unheeded, as the man was cheered, greeted, hugged, and kissed by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. And has anyone thought about that? If Muammar Gaddafi is the dictator, the president, the king, or whatever it is he is there in Libya, the dear leader, why did he never make it past colonel? Someone asked me that this morning at church. Why did Muammar Gaddafi never rise past the rank of colonel, if indeed he is the president, the king, the dictator there in Libya? And now, for all of you people who are uninitiated in military matters, you may not quite understand this, and it may be confusing. One would think that Muammar Gaddafi could just promote himself to general, or even higher. Is there anything higher than general? I don't think so. He could have, but these tinhorn dictators, especially if they come from a militaristic background, have a tendency to want to keep their position separate from the general ranks, because generals are primarily viewed as political appointees, whereas colonels, at least when I was in the Marine Corps, and lieutenant colonels in particular, if you retire as a lieutenant colonel or a colonel, you are seen to be someone who is dedicated to the military and not necessarily to politics per se, which obviously Muammar was not dedicated to the politics of the day since he overthrew the government and took it over as a colonel. And I think that's the reason that Muammar never promoted himself past the rank of colonel. But I digress. That's virtually meaningless to 99% of the people who are listening out there as to Muammar Gaddafi's motivations and the insignia that he wears on his lapel. Let's get back to the disturbing story of Abdelbaset Ali Mohammed El-Megrahi, who is a living martyr of the Islamic fundamentalist jihadi cause. And he's been released over there to a hero's welcome. In a radio interview from the White House, Barry Ho, according to the Mail, said, quote, "We've been in contact with the Scottish government indicating that we objected to this. We thought it was a mistake." Nice work, Barry. You're obviously a very persuasive guy. Let's see. He was released, if you heard the story, apparently released from prison on compassionate grounds. I wasn't aware that a lifetime prison sentence for murdering 270 people. I wasn't sure where compassion fits into that. But apparently, people within the Scottish government who are far nicer than me, far nicer than God even, have determined that Ali Mohammed El-Megrahi... Oh, no, I mispronounced that, I'm sorry. Abdelbaset Ali Mohammed El-Megrahi needs a little bit of compassion now that he is apparently nearing the end of his life. The rumor is that he is dying of prostate cancer and has only months to live, and that's probably more due to the Scottish healthcare system than anything else. And in fact, now that he's been released, he'll probably be smuggled into New York and treated by some of the finest Jewish doctors on the East Side. Well, we'll see what happens there. Apparently, he's only got months to live, and we're all expected to have some compassion. Let's see. The terminally ill 57-year-old convicted terrorist, in a statement released after he landed there on his home soil, he said that his guilty verdict for the Lockerbie bombing was, quote, "nothing short of a disgrace." So I don't see a lot of remorse. I don't sense repentance from Abdelbaset Ali Mohammed El-Megrahi. I just don't think we got through to him in all those years that we kept him in jail. Scottish Parliament, apparently, is going to be recalled this week to debate Megrahi's release, which proves that Parliament is basically just an echo chamber. I mean, the horse has left the barn. For all you Scottish parliamentarians, the terrorist has been released. He's now in Libya, probably conspiring to bomb something else right now as we speak. And the Scottish Parliament wants to get together this week and debate the release. Maybe they will send Superman back around the Earth, and he'll turn the Earth back, and they'll be able to correct the situation. Anyway, we're all wondering, at least I am, thinking people are wondering, why did we release this terrorist? I mean, months to live? What kind of cancer does he have, for crying out loud? I read the story, and 3 seconds later, prostate cancer, come on. He's got 3 months to live, he's going to die of prostate cancer, and suddenly the Scottish have an epiphany and decide to release him. I smelled me a rat. Yes. And from a story from Sky News over in England, there's been claims made by the son of Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. And this young man's name is Saif al-Islam. Yep, that's Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam. He said in a television interview that there were certain trade deals made that facilitated the release of Libya's latest hero, Abdelbaset Ali Mohammed El-Megrahi. Gaddafi's son, Islam, we'll just call him Islam for short, he said, quote, "In all commercial contracts for oil and gas with Britain, Megrahi was always on the negotiating table. All British interests were linked to the release of Abdelbaset al-Megrahi." That's according to Islam, the son of Muammar Gaddafi. Now, the claim was rejected by the Foreign Office there in Scotland, and an angry response then came from the business secretary there in the People's Republic of Scotland. Lord Mendelssohn, who's one of these chaps, I'm not sure which, whether he's with business or the foreign office, he said it's not only completely wrong to make such a suggestion, it's also quite offensive. And I would say to Mr. Mendelssohn There's no comment that can be made at this point in your career, Mr. Mendelsohn, that could be more offensive than the fact that your government has released a convicted terrorist in the midst of the jihad. Note to Lord Mendelsohn, the jihad is not over, in case you hadn't noticed. And releasing a terrorist to a hero's welcome, well, it's just beyond the pale. I think that we should convene a committee, and we should debate this release, so that maybe we can feel better about ourselves or something. I'm not sure. Anyway, very disturbing news. Very odd thing to happen at this juncture, as George Bush Sr. would have said. At this juncture, it's quite strange. Quite strange at this juncture. Oh, well. Okay, so let's move on from that disturbing tale into the politics file. The debate on nationalized health care, socialized health care, the public option, co-ops, whatever you... The debate rages on throughout America as Congress is back home, getting an earful at their town hall meetings. And President Obama has stepped up the rhetoric this week, appealing to the religious among us, as Obama is so wont to do. Talk about a guy with chutzpah. If you look up chutzpah in the dictionary, the online dictionary, I'm sure, there's got to be a picture of Barry Ho. He said, let's see, he had a phone call with some rabbis last week that was recorded, and he basically implied, well, I'll quote what he said, and you make your own mind up. Barry Ho said, quote, "We are God's partners in matters of life and death." We are God's partners, he said, in matters of life and death. Now, he's quoting an old ancient Jewish prayer, and if Barry Ho had the smallest inkling or comprehension of the ancient Jewish mind, of the rabbinical Jewish mind, he might have understood to what he was referring, but I doubt that's the case. I think Barry Ho genuinely considers himself a partner with God in decisions of life and death, and in a sense of the word, he indeed is. He's the president of the United States of America. He makes decisions that involve life and death every day. At this point, we don't think he's making decisions that involve the life or death of, say, an old sick person in a hospital, but he's willing to partner up with God on that one too, apparently. And that's a little bit disturbing, that Barry Ho wants to be God's partner in matters of life and death. In fact, he considers himself already a partner in matters of life and death. And he says it, and I don't think he really understands what it means, but we could all be afraid, be very, very afraid, that perhaps he does know exactly what it means, and he's prepared to hold up his end of the deal, let's say, especially on the death side of things. When it comes to old sick people. Wasn't there a quote this week, was it Barry Ho that said that when his grandmother needed a hip replacement and she was 80-something years old, that it presented him with some kind of moral dilemma? I mean, I could see it being a financial dilemma to have to replace Granny's hips, but a moral dilemma? I'm not sure I get that. But I don't know. I don't contribute regularly to Planned Parenthood, and I didn't read Margaret Sanger's book, you know, as if it were a religious tome. So perhaps I have a lack of understanding, and perhaps Barry will enlighten all of us as the days go forward. Okay. So, but Republicans apparently are under the impression that the healthcare debate, at least a large portion of it, has been won in that there's been some easing in the rhetoric toward the public option, the full-blown socialized medicine option. I'm not buying it. Just like I told you last week, they can call it a co-op, they can call it a prayer circle, they can call it whatever they want. I don't believe these people. They're out to socialize medicine, line their pockets, and basically get rid of people who they consider non-productive. Useless eaters, so to speak. And once they've made it that far, and they get rid of the useless eaters, and the homosexuals continue their insurgency into the United States government, it's just a matter of time before they come after the useless breeders. I am Doug McBurney, glad to have you with me and my extremely attractive audio engineer. We're two of the useless breeders, by the way, as is most of the listening audience. You bunch of breeders out there, having all those kids. Well, what were we watching last night? We were watching 18 Kids and Counting, the Duggar family, is that their name? You know, you'll remember way, way back, folks, when I first relaunched the broadcast back in March, April. Anyway, if you go back and listen to the first couple shows, I made some dire predictions about one John and Kate plus eight, and that was before the current scandal erupted and the divorce and all that. I just made some observations about their child-rearing skills and practices. And, you know, we hope everything works out well for John and Kate and the little brats from their TV show. But you gotta, this Duggar family is downright inspirational if you watch these folks. I mean, here's a guy who really seems to have it together. He's dedicated to his family. His wife has had 18 kids. She looks fantastic, and she's just high energy, and the kids all seem so motivated. And I think one of the sons is now, his wife is pregnant, so now the grandkids come into the scene. And I'm imagining that the Duggars there from 18 Kids and Counting, their primary means of income right now, and their job now is their TV show. And, well, I just wish them the best, and I hope it doesn't ruin them. And it was really a pleasure to watch. If you haven't had a chance to see it, it's on, I don't know, it's on some cable channel. TLC? TCM?
I don't
want to. It's got a T in there. I don't know what channel it's on. It's like channel 386 or something. Yeah, they're not buying any advertising. We're not going to give out the network. But now, how did I get sidetracked into that? That wasn't at all what I was thinking about. I wanted to give you an update on New York's fearless governor, David Paterson. He said last Friday that the media, according to the Associated Press, the media has exploited racial stereotypes in coverage of him and President Barack Obama and fellow black governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts. So here's David Paterson whipping out the race card again and not knowing where he's throwing it. And not to make fun of his physical handicap. It's his overwhelming stupidity and ineptitude even that I'm making fun of. Anyway, David Paterson, he says, quote, "My feeling is that it's being orchestrated. It's a game. And people who pay attention know that." And I'm thinking, what does that line mean? What is being orchestrated? What is a game? Who are the people that know? And what are you talking about, man? I mean, you're the governor of New York? He said that black media outlets, as opposed to all those cracker media outlets that you and I watch. He said black media outlets from our own community buy the public line, which is, we're going to get rid of David Paterson. And I'm thinking, Dave, it's not because you're black. It's because you're a moron. I mean, please. Come on. But, you know, sometimes when someone is this stupid, they don't really realize it. And so they assume that it's a racial thing. Or maybe it's because he's handicapped and he doesn't realize that it's just because he's a bozo. Let's see. He says certain, let's see here. Is this Paterson? Oh, this was a written statement.
He said, what I did point out was that certain media outlets have engaged in coverage that exploits racial stereotypes. That's not only unfair, it's wrong. And it sends an objectionable message.
Again, I'm saying, what are you talking about, Dave? Are you off your medications? I mean, you know, I think we stopped using electroshock therapy sometime after World War II, but here's a candidate for it right here. He says, we have a
long way to go to achieve a truly post-racial society.
And I'm thinking, Dave, it'll really help if we just could achieve a post-Patterson society. Then maybe we could move on, start making some progress, especially there in the state of New York. Those people got to feel pretty embarrassed. I mean, first they elect Hillary Clinton. Then their sitting governor, Elliot Spitzer, gets himself entangled into a bit of a, well, a scandal. Let's just leave it at that. And they end up with this idiot. And it's... I mean, can you imagine living in New York and having to, you know, that I haven't called my family in quite a while, but the last time I spoke with them, they expressed their embarrassment and their fear of being shunned by people outside of their state because of the state of New York, which is just tragic. All right. Now, let's move on from basically a semi-literate semi-dangerous, just a fellow who's not all that bright, David Patterson. Let's move on to one of the most dangerous politicians in the history of the United States government, Senator Edward M. Kennedy. Dateline Providence, Rhode Island, from the Associated Press, Representative Patrick Kennedy said last Friday that his father, Edward M. Kennedy, has been very frustrated to be absent from Washington during the debate over health care reform. Now, Patrick Kennedy is a Rhode Island Democrat, and he told the Associated Press that his father, quote, has a unique ability to read his colleagues and negotiate compromises. And he's been, and Patrick's just beside himself. He called his father a master legislator and a statesman. A statesman, he said, of Edward M. Kennedy. And again, you know, sometimes you're too close to the forest to really see the trees. Now, Patrick, he's home with the other, what is he, a senator? I don't know. He's a representative. He's a senator. He's something, right? Patrick Kennedy. He's planning on having his own town hall meeting on September 3rd. And he says critics of Democratic health reform have blatantly misrepresented facts, causing confusion and unnecessary concern that people would be forced to change their health plan, even if they like it. If the health care overhaul fails, he warns, America would be left with an unmanageable system. And I would just remind young Mr. Patrick Kennedy that that's the system that Ted Kennedy gave us. Don't you remember? Ted Kennedy's been legislating for almost 50 years. He built the health care system, at least the government encumbrances thereupon, and he has handed us the system that is so dreadfully failing all of us, and now, apparently, the Democrats want to expand that failure so that everyone can be involved. Just embarrassing. Let's see. Representative Kennedy's father, Edward M. Kennedy, was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor way back in May 2008. He underwent a risky, aggressive surgery shortly after his diagnosis, but since then has been convalescing. Darn it. I mean, I'm hoping that would build to a crescendo and say, you know, he dropped dead night before last, but no. A malignant brain tumor. Now, folks, you can't tell me that you believe that God predestines everything and writes history, because surely if God put a malignant brain tumor into Ed Kennedy's head, it would have worked by now, for crying out loud. I don't think God is responsible here. All right, now, let's see here. Oh, interesting note here. Earlier this week, this past week, Edward Kennedy sent a letter to Massachusetts leaders asking that they change state law to allow someone to be quickly appointed to his seat in Congress should a vacancy somehow occur. Though his aide said there has been no material change to his condition. Oh, man. Well, all right, well, we can still hope. We can still hope against hope. But, you know, Teddy, he's probably going to put someone in there who's twice the demonic child of hell that he is. Let's see here. Patrick Kennedy didn't discuss his father's health other than to say, I love being with him, and all the time that I've been given to be with him these past several months to a year have been just a blessing to me and my family. That's Patrick. He says, my dad has the principle of ensuring the best possible deal for the American people regarding health care, and he also has the practicality to know what can be accomplished in a given political environment. He is the master legislator. Now, what is a legislator? Doesn't that mean that he makes up laws? Right? Isn't that what a legislator does? Someone who invents laws? You know, kind of like what Ted did that night in 1968 when he went over the bridge there at Chappaquiddick and he ended up in the water and he knew that there was a law against killing a young girl. But at that moment, in his own legislative mind, as the wheels began turning, he apparently arrived at a new law that he created. Out of thin air, stating that the future political concerns of an up-and-coming congressman from Massachusetts in a very famous political family clearly outweigh the needs of the girl who is currently gurgling in the back seat of my car as it sinks to the bottom of the river. So, a master legislator indeed, able to legislate on the spot in a real tight pitch. Teddy's a very, very impressive legislator. Now, legislators make up laws. And more often than not, as we see with our example of Teddy Kennedy, Edward M. Kennedy, they make up laws without the knowledge, without any respect for the law that has already been revealed to us by our Creator. You know, someone needs to let these legislators know that laws should be discovered. They should not be invented. You know? The law already exists. It simply reveals itself in any given situation. You know, I remember a conversation I had with a supervisor at a previous engagement where I worked years ago. I told him that and I had just become a Christian. I just started to crack my Bible open again, just starting to get familiar with the Word again. And I remember asserting to him that the Ten Commandments cover every possible crime, every possible sin. We don't need any more. And I remember day after day I would come in and be doing work and he would come out to me and he would lay out some sophisticated, complex crime by which money was embezzled through a bank and through a store. And at the end I would say, thou shalt not steal. And this went on for several weeks until he finally gave up because he couldn't think of a sin so complex and so convoluted that it wasn't covered by the Ten Commandments. And in fact, I think I could have just given him 4 of the 10, and he probably couldn't have gotten out of that. But I was a new Christian at the time. But where was I going with that? Oh, yeah, legislators. I have no use for them. I think they need to be reined in. And in the case of Edward M. Kennedy, I think he should be the first person reviewed by one of Obama's death panels. Let's review that case, okay? I'd volunteer to sit on that death panel. All right, now I don't want to get into the domestic tranquility file because we're coming up here on a break. So let's go to New Jersey. Let's instead go to New Jersey. From the Associated Press, Dateline Patterson, New Jersey, the hometown of our pastor at Denver Bible Church, Patterson, New Jersey. Curfews might not just be for kids anymore, according to the AP, in Patterson, which is a city in northern New Jersey. Officials in Patterson are considering a curfew for people of all ages in a bid to curb violence after a spate of deadly shootings. Several experts say they believe that such a curfew would be the first in the nation's history that includes adults. But the New Jersey ACLU says that it would open Patterson, New Jersey, not David Patterson. Isn't this funny? Speaking of morons. David Patterson, we go to Patterson. Anyway, the ACLU says that it would open Patterson to legal action. So even the ACLU recognizes pure stupidity. But they're partly to blame for this. I'm sure it's the liberalization of criminal laws that the ACLU has propagated for the last 40 years that has led to a society that tolerates shootings, murder, bloodshed, stabbings, kidnappings, beatings, assaults. These criminals are tolerated in that they're housed for some period of time and then they're released. So the ACLU is partly responsible, but they say, well, now we can't have a curfew. So they, on the one end, they won't let us have a death penalty to put the fear of God into criminals' hearts and to serve as an example to people who might be considering crime. But on the other hand, they won't let us have a curfew to just try to clear the streets just so that there's not a crossfire as we're going down to the Rite Aid for a pack of gum. So the ACLU, I want to volunteer to have them examined. Every one of them. Every card-carrying member by one of Barry Ho's death panels. So the death panels, by the way, are one of the few things in the health care bill that I support. But I would only support them if I can be directly involved with making the decisions and determining who gets put before the death panel. Let's see. Apparently they're going to vote there. Oh, let's see. The curfew would last up to 2 months for, the rest of the summer. And it would bar people from loitering outside from midnight to 7 a.m. Violators would face up to a $2,000 fine and up to 90 days in jail. The city council, the student council there in Patterson, is going to vote on it on September 1st. And yada, 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 who really cares? Anyway. So for those of you from Patterson, New Jersey... Well, what can you say? I mean, it is New Jersey, but hey, let's crank up those death panels for the ACLU. I'm back. She wants to hear the whole song. It's like, hey, aren't you interested in my take on the news? She's like, come on. This is beating around the bush. This is a great tune. All right. Quit fooling around. All right, now, let's see. From the serious news of David Patterson, Patterson, New Jersey, we will move into the disturbing news from the Domestic Tranquility File. Let's see here now. I don't want to. Yeah, okay. Yeah, this is a part of the show I hate, but I feel like I have to document this because people may not realize the fact that whilst we are engaged in a two-front war against Islamic fundamentalism, the primary source of death, destruction, mayhem, and terror in the United States is from us. It's from within. Dateline Southbridge, Massachusetts, from LifeNews.com. A Massachusetts man has been arrested and is in custody following an alleged multiple stabbing which saw him attack his pregnant girlfriend after she refused to have an abortion. Cases like this one, according to Life News, partners attacking their wives or girlfriends after an abortion refusal are somewhat common. In the most recent case, Life News tells us that Charles Daniels Jr., a 34-year-old man from Florida, is accused of assaulting his pregnant girlfriend when she refused an abortion request. Some 36 states have unborn victims laws on the books that allow prosecutors to charge criminals with killing or injuring an unborn child in addition to any crime against the mother. Massachusetts, the home of Edward M. Kennedy, allows additional charges if the baby is killed after the point of viability. After the point of viability. That's Massachusetts. I'm not sure how they define that. This is horrifying to think that a woman is pressured into having an abortion by the man who used her and then assaulted and physically assaulted, maybe even killed because she refuses to have an abortion. And it's so ridiculous that these states have these unborn victims laws on their books when there's one law that will fix all this, and that's the personhood law that we're fighting for out here in Colorado, Montana, Oregon, California, Nevada. How many states now? There's a number of states where we're actively... Mississippi. God bless Cal Zastro in Mississippi gathering those signatures. But this Massachusetts law confounds me the most. Obviously, if personhood laws similar to the one we're working on here in Colorado were passed, there would be no need for unborn victims laws or convoluted, complex laws to try to punish criminals for killing people. Because that's all it is. A murder is the killing of an innocent person. And we don't need to get all convoluted and complex about it. It's a fairly simple assessment to make. Whereas in Massachusetts, allowing additional charges if the baby is killed after the point of viability. How do you define that? Is the point of viability? Let's see, in Massachusetts, I would assume that that's the point at which it could be determined that the baby could have been able to swim out of Ted Kennedy's car after that, after the crash. That would be determined as the point of viability. Anyway, just ridiculous. Okay. From Detroit and the Associated Press, a 12-year-old Detroit boy accused of shooting a 24-year-old woman to death during a street robbery could face an adult murder sentence of life in prison without parole if, indeed, he is in the unlikely event that he's convicted. According to police, the boy tried to rob Trisha Babcock, a 24-year-old woman, just after midnight on August 1st. She had recently come to Detroit seeking work as a dancer. Okay. Detroit seeking work as a dancer. Note to you young ladies out there, if you're considering a career change, going to Detroit in search of work as a dancer could be fatal. This young man has been charged with felony murder, armed robbery, having a firearm during a felony, and violating curfew. So that I guess if these other ones don't stick, they're just going to fall back on the curfew violation. Try and get him a life sentence for that. This is how ridiculous the justice system has become. A man shoots a woman to death in cold blood, and the poor police and the prosecutors, they've got to throw every possible charge up at this guy in hopes that they can get something to stick, something that the ACLU and NYU lawyers won't be able to finagle their way around and get this kid out of jail. Or get him out of punishment. I personally don't want him in jail. In fact, I would opt for a death panel for this young man. Let's see here. Police Chief Warren Evans there in Detroit, he told reporters last week, he said, quote, "I could not have been out at night when I was 12. Things have changed," unquote. So that's the sheriff. The police chief there in Detroit. And I would ask Police Chief Warren Evans, even if you had been allowed to be out at midnight when you were 12 years old, would you have had murder in your heart? Would you have been looking for women to rob and kill? I mean, that's where things have changed, Police Chief Evans. It's what's in these kids' hearts. It's not that I remember sneaking out of my house. Now, I don't want the youngsters in the audience to hear this. I probably shouldn't have said that. Anyway, I remember roaming the streets as a teenager in the wee hours of the morning. Never did I have an intention to rob or kill or beat or hurt or strangle or stab anyone. I was trying to have fun, activities did not strike me as fun. But apparently, for some of these youngsters out there, and a growing number of them, if you follow the domestic tranquility file, that is fun, and that's what's changed. Chief Evans. and it's going to take more than a curfew to fix that, my friend. Dateline Bellingham, Washington. A woman who put chemical cleaners into two malts that injured several customers has pleaded guilty to second-degree assault. Alexandra M. Dale was sentenced to 14 months in prison. Apparently, two men who bought malts in February suffered chemical burns, and one man was even hospitalized for 2 days with ulcers on his esophagus. Ouch! Ulcers on the esophagus. That can't be pleasant. Anyway, the Bellingham Herald newspaper reports that surveillance video showed that Dale added deep fat fryer cleaner to the malt dispenser at the Ferndale Dairy Queen. Deputy Prosecutor Donna Brake says that a 40-year-old Ferndale woman never admitted to a motive but had applied for a different job with the company and thought she had been given short shrift. So here's a woman apparently passed over for a minimum wage job who takes it upon herself to poison the patrons of the Dairy Queen. Now, to me, if you put poison in someone's drink, you should be charged at the very minimum with attempted murder, and you should be duly tried, and if convicted, well, I would again volunteer to sit on that death panel. All right. Dateline Phoenix, Arizona. A Phoenix woman accused of torturing and killing a man in a wheelchair says she did it because he was a snitch. She says she enjoyed it and doesn't regret it at all. Angela Simpson said in a jailhouse interview that she lured the 46-year-old wheelchair-bound Terry Neely to her apartment. Once there, Simpson says she beat Neely with a tire iron, pulled out his teeth, and strangled him with a television cable during 3 days of torture. Simpson says she dismembered Neely's body and then set it on fire. The man's remains were found burning in a trash container outside a church back on August 5th. Autopsy results show that a 3-inch nail had been driven into his head. And she has no remorse, and she says she enjoyed it. My, things have changed. Dateline the Bronx from the Reuters Wire. A troubled Bronx teen, allegedly in a zombie-like trance state, stabbed his two younger brothers and sister and was prevented from murdering them by a Good Samaritan. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the concept of a Good Samaritan, well, wait a minute. There's no one out there who is not familiar with the concept of a Good Samaritan, is there? Everybody knows what a Good Samaritan is, at least everyone in the English-speaking Western world. Why is that? Because the Bible is the only book on earth where if every single Bible were completely destroyed and burned by Barry Ho and his M.O. and the Democratic Party, the Bible would still exist. It would still be extant through quotations in other books and in the minds of the public. So the Bible is a book that's so powerful that it cannot be stomped out completely. Now, it can be rejected and refused by those who read it, but the Nazis and the socialists and the Bolsheviks and the humanists are not going to be able to get rid of the Bible. So you all know what a Good Samaritan is, so I won't delve into that. If you're not familiar, read the four Gospels. Read all four of them. It's in there somewhere. Trust me. Let's see. What happened here now in our domestic tranquility file? 17-year-old Nelson Santos attacked his two brothers, 13 and 6 years old, and his 9-year-old sister with a knife in their apartment. The boys said that he was seeing demons, and neighbors said that he practiced black magic. He was 17 years old. Let's see. Now, the younger brother who had been stabbed, 13-year-old Miguel, he was drenched in his own blood when he dashed out of the living room and downstairs, and he called for help. Nelson Santos was screaming something about Armageddon and chasing his younger brother with a big kitchen knife, according to Good Samaritan John Flores, who was a neighbor. He wrestled with Santos as he tried to stop them. And his mother, Delilah, was able to grab the butcher knife out of the clutches of the young maniac. All of the victims were sent to the hospital. Let's see here. The 13-year-old was listed in stable condition. 9-year-old, stable. So apparently everyone survived. 17-year-old sees demons, hears voices in his head. I have a feeling there might have been drugs involved, but I guess we'll have to await the toxicology reports to confirm that. My, how things have changed. Dateline Detroit, Michigan. Back to Detroit. A teenager was shot by Detroit police after a member of an advanced crew for a film titled Little Murder was robbed at gunpoint. The film crew was at a West Side site at about 2:30 in the afternoon, broad daylight, last Friday when two armed teens robbed one of the workers of his wallet and cell phone. Police chased and shot a suspect in the shoulder when he pointed a shotgun at officers. A second suspect was caught a short time later. The stolen items were recovered. And the Associated Press tells us, interestingly enough, that Michigan and Detroit have been prime filming locations after the state tax incentives went into effect last year. The refundable movie tax credit of up to 42% on production expenses is the nation's most lucrative. So Detroit has been working hard to try to bring film crews into the city to film. They've given them some huge tax credits. And so if you want to shoot a film like they were shooting here, a film entitled Little Murder, did you get that? The title of the film was Little Murder. Well, if you want to film something like that, and you want a backdrop that looks like a burned-out, crime-ridden, gang-infested hellhole, well, come to Detroit. We've got it all.
The devil says...
Worldview. Doug McBurney back with you as we round third and head for home. I want to jump right into the justice file. I was going to go to the culture file, but I feel like I need to make sure that I get this justice news in. Dateline Madison, Wisconsin, from the Associated Press. A hermit who encased his dead mother in a block of ice keeps himself in solitary confinement while he's there in prison by threatening people, swearing at guards, and refusing to leave his cell. Philip Schuth told a newspaper when he was sentenced to prison back in 2005 that he feared that other inmates, and wanted to live in solitary confinement. Apparently prison conduct reports show that Schuth is as good as his word. He's been working hard to do that. He's earned more than 1,400 days in solitary confinement since his imprisonment back in 2005. His attorney says, quote, he's somebody who just wants to be left alone. You know, I hear a lot of people say that. And there are going to be a lot of people on Judgment Day who say that. They're going to say just that. They're going to say, who are you to rule over me? I just want to be left alone. And the creator of the universe, the judge of all the earth, is going to say, you know what? Fine. I'm going to leave you alone for eternity. And you know, I think that within a matter of a few minutes, or possibly hours, in the case of this maniac, Mr. Schuth, they're going to regret having wanted to be left alone so bad. Yeah. Because, we all like to have our privacy and our moments of solitude and all that, but what's the worst thing? To me, the worst thing, because I've got a wife and three beautiful kids, and I've got a lot of great friends and a great church, and I enjoy companionship and relationships and fellowship. And the worst thing I can imagine is being left alone when no one ever calls, no one ever returns your calls, no one even leaves a message for you. Well, that is the sliver of what hell is like, except it's a lot worse than just not getting your calls returned, I'm sure. What with the flames and all. Okay. Dateline, Starkey, Florida. Good news on the justice front. Florida has executed a man convicted of murdering a woman who was kidnapped and assaulted after her car broke down. 47-year-old John Richard Merrick died from a nice, soft, mushy, cushy, easy-going, free love, lethal injection at 6:33 p.m. This past week. For the June 16th, 1983 slaying of Adele Maria Simmons. 1983. Let's do the math together, ladies and gentlemen. 93-03. That's 26 years. A little over 26 years between the crime and the punishment. And this is why the death penalty is broken in America. How can you expect the death penalty to resonate with the public when they can't even recall the crime for which this person is being executed? A goodly percentage of the people weren't even born. A good percentage of the people you're trying to scare straight with the death penalty weren't even born when this crime committed, when this crime was committed. It's just, it's broken. And there's other details, but I frankly don't care. Good news, John Richard Merrick is dead after 26 years of languishing in prison. let's see. I have another story here from the justice file that I want to make sure that I get to, but want to make sure that I get the dateline right, and I'm not going to be able to. Well, I'll get it as I read the story. Dateline prison, somewhere, from the Sun over in the United Kingdom. Record producer Phil Spector is in the same prison as cult massacre maniac Charles Manson, and he's not happy about it. He has told the newspaper there of his terror at being held in a snake pit prison with crazed killers. So Phil Spector doesn't understand why he's being lumped in with murderers. He just doesn't get it. You know, he's in there with Charles Manson, Sirhan Sirhan. And he says, let's see. What does he have to say? He says, imagine sending me to the same prison as these people. It shows how low they can go. They'd kill you in here for a 39-cent can of soup, says Phil Spector. And I just want to ask him, what exactly did he kill that young girl at his house for? Was it over something more significant than soup, or something less than soup? What exactly was it, Phil, that pushed you over the edge when you put that gun in that girl's mouth and pulled the trigger? Not that you're Charles Manson or anything like that, don't get me wrong. Anyway, he also, he described the Darwinian blessing, he says, of a visit by his ex-model wife, Rachel, who's 29 years old. She visited him in the jail at Corcoran. There it is. Corcoran, the Supermax prison. There's her dateline. Corcoran Supermax prison in California. That's where Phil Spector currently resides. And he's not happy about it. He feels like he's above such things. He really feels like they should have put him in like a rented condo somewhere in Hollywood if they, you know, wanted to punish him. Anyway, which do you think would be more likely to produce remorse in a fellow like Phil Spector? If after the trial, the judge would have taken him into a concrete room and said, Phil, in 3 days, we're going to stick a gun in your mouth, and we're going to blow the top of your head off, and you're going to meet your maker. So, Phil, here's a Bible, and here's a notepad. Why don't you just sit here? Here's the phone numbers of some good pastoral counseling. Sit here and think about it, because in 3 days, you're on your way, pal. We're going to send you right through the wall of sound, okay? You're going to break on through to the other side, so to speak. Do you think that would have a more of an effect rather than sending him to prison with Charles Manson and Sirhan Sirhan for the rest of his life in a snake pit? Does it sound like we're getting through to Phil Spector? I think not. And we're just missing a great opportunity there. Even Phil is probably salvageable. Well, maybe not. But maybe, right? Where there's life, there's hope. And where there's a 3-day impending death sentence, there's a lot of hope that someone could come around and realize that you're a scumbag murderer. You're no better than Sirhan Sirhan. You're no better than Charles Manson. You're a dirtbag murderer who belongs in a snake pit, but only for 3 days before we blow the top of your head off. All right. Now on to the culture file. Now, Dateline Detroit. Boy, we're spending a lot of time in Detroit this week. Ramadan, the holy Muslim month, will begin in August for the first time in 33 years. Have we got our Ramadan tree up already? Is it up? Because it starts just in a few days here. Ramadan will be creeping deeper and deeper into summer for each of the next 7 years because the Islamic lunar calendar is roughly 11 days shorter than the international solar calendar. That means Muslims in the U.S. face longer, hotter days of religious devotion because of longer, hotter summer days. And you know what happens to Muslims when they have long, hot days of religious devotion. They end up cutting someone's head off or blowing up a building or a car or something. No, the Ramadan tree isn't up yet. Well, we're going to work on that right after the show. We're going to be putting up our decorations around the house. Do I want to talk any more about Ramadan? Not really. So let's just move that aside. Dateline New York City. This is just disturbing. A self-employed graphic designer methodically killed at least 4 of his girlfriend's cats and tortured 2 others while the unsuspecting woman continued to adopt new cats over a 4-month period. I agree. I've got our studio audience is crying over this story. Now, don't cry, dear. Sean Lind. Okay. Any more tears from the peanut gallery there? Okay. Sean Lind was arrested on charges including 6 counts of felony animal cruelty. He moved into his girlfriend's Upper West Side apartment back in October 1st of 08. There's your first mistake. 3 days later, her 15-year-old cat Cleo was found dead behind a dryer with her mouth full of laundry detergent. I know, it's horrible. It's just awful. The cat also had a broken jaw. A necropsy revealed the cat had head trauma from being beaten. A second cat A 12-year-old cat suffered extensive head trauma and had to be euthanized by the end of the same month. And then in November, I know, it's awful. It's awful. I like kitty cats too, honey. In November, the woman adopted two kittens, and one became unresponsive after his first night in the couple's home and had trouble walking because its legs had stiffened from some sort of trauma, and the second kitten died November 24th. Lynn told the veterinarian the kitten had suffered head damage and stopped breathing after falling off a table. Okay, that's kind of hard to believe, that a cat falls off a table and cracks his skull open. Anyway, the woman continued, oblivious, obviously, to the fact that she was shacking up with some psychomaniac. She adopted two more kittens on December 18th, and later that same day, one was treated for a broken paw. Shortly before Christmas, the final kitten suffered trauma resulting in blindness and brain damage, and then the kitten's body was found in January with its neck broken. And what's the point of that whole story? You know... To watch who you shack up with. In fact, don't shack up. You might be shacking up with some maniacal, crazed killer. It might go after you and not the cat. Okay, Dateline Minneapolis, Minnesota. Leaders of the country's largest Lutheran denomination have moved toward a more welcoming view of homosexuality. Just great. The Lutherans. Yeah. Delegates of the Evangelical Lutheran Church had a vote, and they said that they've released a social statement on human sexuality. They acknowledge there are differing views among the congregation, but they say that the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is strong enough to accommodate such differences. And I quote from the Bible, warning, 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 Will Robinson, there are Bible verses up ahead for those in the audience who advocate pluralism and diversity. We know here at the Weekly Worldview that you would not tolerate anyone who would dare quote a Bible verse in public. So this warning gives you fair notice that raw, unadulterated truth is about to be uttered. Proverbs, the 6th chapter and the 27th verse. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? So I'm warning you, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, you're taking fire into your bosom. And you are going to get burned. Yeah, you are. Now, that verse in Proverbs, if you read it in context, it's talking about sexual immorality in general. But believe me, that encompasses this whole debate about homosexuals in the church, even homosexuals in the clergy. It's just disturbing what's going on out there. And I'm not going to have time to talk about Annie Leibovitz going broke. I would have wanted to talk about that. Annie Leibovitz is on the brink of bankruptcy. As is the generation she inspired with her semi-pornographic photos. Look up the story yourself. You'll be mildly entertained at the irony of Annie Leibovitz headed for the poorhouse. But we're out of time, so I want to thank everyone over at Denver Bible Church for the inspiration that you give us every day. For our good friends at Personhood USA, who are on the verge of changing the world and maybe even saving Western civilization. Everyone over at Theology Online and our leadership at American Right to Life for all that you do. And, of course, my other brother, Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I want to thank you for being with us, and I hope you'll join us again next week when we will be back to focus the events of the week through the lens of original thought. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.